everybody. It's Marvin here in the city of brotherly love.
This is Michael in Williamstown.
This is Josh in the Mississippi of the North.
Yo, what's good? This is Jesse out in Oakland, California. We wanted to welcome y'all to another installment of the Melanated Social Work Podcast. Just wanted to give a big shout out to everyone who's been supporting the merchandise. During the month of June, we ran a campaign where 50% of the proceeds would be donated to grassroots Black liberation organizations. We just wrapped up for the month of June, and thank y'all. Because of all y'all purchases, we're able to make a donation of $1,000. So we really appreciate support. For those of y'all that have been picking up the merch, please make sure you post it, tag us on IG so we can share that out. But we're really feeling the love, y'all. In addition, we just wanted to give y'all a heads up that recently we also were the esteemed guests. We got to guest lecture for a couple of sessions at Smith College. Want to give a shout out to Professor Paul Gitterman out there that was kind enough to invite us out there. And just to give y'all a heads up that if you think y'all would benefit either at your institution of higher education, your nonprofit, wherever it is, if you want to have us come in and do a guest lecture, some facilitation training, please just holler at us. Hit us up in the email, melanatedsocialwork@gmail.com. Today on the episode, we're kind of bringing it back to one of our earlier episodes. We're looking at white supremacy in the workplace. You know, we've gotten a lot of requests, folks who really enjoy that episode and just wanting us to go back and revisit it. And this moment felt like a good time to do that. So I just want to kick it off real quick and just ask y'all gentlemen, what's coming up for you in this moment, just being a Black clinician and supporting folks through like this ongoing racial trauma that we're experiencing?
For me, most of my clients aren't really that strongly affected by this. And I think I may have mentioned this in a previous episode, but, you know, obviously there's a lot going on with the murders and the protests and Karens and all that stuff. But for the most part, my clients who are majority Black or African American, they haven't been that affected by it. I have had some clients talk about having anxiety at, you know, seeing police officers or at night walking around, just because folks are getting lynched now, apparently, because that's where we are now. But for the most part, it's just about work. Like a lot of their stress comes from work, and, you know, having organizations that say Black Lives Matter, but then still doing the same problematic shit. Well, a lot of it is like, how do I navigate as a person of color in this corporation, nonprofit, school district, this entity that historically has not given a fuck about us at all, and now all of a sudden they're acting like it, but then not really doing anything to fix the situation. And so I think that is more of what I'm getting than kind of than clients feeling fear of their own safety. My clients are dope too, so they've been out at these protests. They've been doing the damn thing. So
for sure. Yeah. You did the therapist thing. I think what I'm more curious about is not so much how your clients are doing. I'm more curious about, like, how are you doing?
Ooh.
What is coming up for you?
Okay, therapist. I see you.
Being a Black clinician in this moment.
Yeah. Shit is rough. as I tell everybody, it's an emotional roller coaster for me. Because you, as a Black man, I can easily see myself as the next hashtag, as the next person that is gonna, you know, be the victim of a Karen. And I don't know if the police are gonna show up one time and, you know, slam me on the ground and potentially take my life, or am I just gonna record this Karen and ruin her life? I don't know. I was, you know, just sharing with y'all before we got on this call that for the first time I had a dream that was connected to everything going on, in which I was in a car, in the backseat of a car. Two of my friends in the front seat went into a store to do something, and all of a sudden, all of these police came out, and there was one white police officer, gun p- pointed straight at me. I've been doing this work for a while. I've been hearing a lot of horrific things from clients, from whoever, but I've never had a dream like that ever. So it's going to be interesting once my therapist gets back so we can talk about it. But it definitely, you know, for me, I posted something recently that was like, be patient with me because I don't know which version of myself I'm going to get on a daily basis. Some days I wake up and I'm ready to go. I'm ready to fight the fight. I'm ready to post. Other days I wake up and I'm just like, you know, there's that dark cloud. Just like, you know what? I don't do anything today. Like, I don't have energy for anything. Like, fuck, I have clients today. Maybe I should cancel, but I need money. So like, let me just try to, you know, get my shit together so I can, you know, stay present for this hour and then get right back to the couch because like, this is my mood right now. So it's been, you know, up and down.
For me, similar things as far as what Martin was saying, as far as you have the better days and then you have the challenging days. I think overall, it's a very, from personal to professional, it's a very scary time. I went on a little jog, walk, nature trail with my partner the other day, and we saw so much, graffiti that was saying Black Lives Matter are a terrorist group, Trump 2020 forever, All Lives Matter. So that's in my personal life, right? Also in personal life, nobody really can see what I'm wearing, but I try to wear college stuff to make it seem like, I probably mentioned it in another episode, to make myself seem approachable or okay, or unfortunately, one of the good ones. Before I go and I go exercise outside, I'll, you know, text and send a location to my loved one just in case something happens. I try to make sure my phone battery is full just in case I'm going to have to record or actually be there for other people. I've actually seen some law enforcement stop an attack or at least question Black women. And I was across the street waving at them once the law enforcement left, asking them when they were okay. I had my phone out. I stopped my workout just to be safe and, you know, be a bystander just in case something would happen. And one thing that I've noticed a lot of anti-Blackness, and it's always been there around the world, but more so specifically in social work. Recently, Jesse posted him being in Oakland during a protest or an uprising. And a lot of protests that I see, they give you hand sanitizer. You can't come unless you have a mask. These things are as safe as possible, right? Also in the code of ethics, in the social work code of ethics, it teaches us to stand up in these times. And I saw a social worker that went to Boston College kind of question us. Like, I thought coronavirus is over. And I'm like, you think we want to protest during these times? I'm sorry. And I'm going to be blunt. This person identifies person of color, but that's just like Sean King saying he's Black. This person's white and will never understand why Black people and people of color, because he's not one, have to do these types of things in these types of times. Mm-hmm. This person gaslit me and told me I should use my social work skills. Mm-hmm. He's like, you can't have a civil conversation. I was like, use your social work skills. I'm like, well, why don't you use your social work skills to pass your licensure exam before you come talk to me first, fam? And he didn't say anything. And I've seen, even on social media, I've seen social workers post Blue Lives Matter. Now, if that's what you want to post in your personal thing, that's one thing. But when you mm-hmm. talk about social work things and your stuff in the same breath as Blue Lives Matter, that's a little bit concerning. Like, there's no in between, right? I've even seen a non-Black person of color recently tell me, you know, I shouldn't say the N-word. Like, that's not your cue to tell me how to do anything, right? I've seen anti-Blackness across the board in very non-Black communities. Mm-hmm. I've seen it in the social work field. I've seen stuff on social media with different groups tearing down Black Lives Matter or saying, well, what about us? Or what about this life or that life? Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of non-Black people, some telling Black people how to feel in these times. I've even seen in the media, there's a woman in Atlanta named Monica Matthews who was on the radio, and she said some disparaging things about a black woman who's on TV in Atlanta. This white woman said, my husband, who died in 1999, was black. She said, my daughter's biracial. My boyfriend is black. Don't paint me as something I'm not. And she's also All Lives Matter and MAGA, right? And another thing that I've seen is a lot. I've always seen it in general before these times, but in these specific tumultuous anti-black times when we're doing these uprisings, you know, one time Ice Cube once said, black police showing out for the white cops. And what I've seen in a lot of these places and spaces with some of these black faces for neo-colonialist white supremacy organizations are black executives showing out for white executives and not really doing anything and holding white people accountable and continuing the status quo. So it's just been very frustrating for me. Because you would think that the people who need to say and step up would say something right now, and they're not. So it's just very frustrating.
Yeah, I hear that frustration. And also what Marvin was talking about, kind of depending on the day, I've been feeling really ungrounded lately, to be honest. And I think part of it is this, like the significance of the serious of the moment, and also feeling like things are like really ramping up. And I have this analogy of like, you know, when a car is like picking up speed and you have less control and like the traction, it seems like the car is like starting to like level off the ground a little bit. Like that's how I feel ungrounded with the way that things are ramping up. And I've been, part of it is thinking about like, what are my actual like beliefs? Because we're hearing calls to like dismantle like capitalism. And so I've been trying to unpack like, well, yeah, I don't agree with like haves and have nots. And I know Fred Hampton said, you don't fight capitalism with black capitalism, you fight it with socialism. So I've been trying to assess like, okay, what does it mean to be a socialist? And then propping up Angela Davis quotes, and she's a self-proclaimed communist. So I'm like, okay, what does it mean to be a communist? So I'm trying to like unpack these isms and figure out where do I align within this system, and also like within patriarchy too. Like I was just having a conversation with my partner, and we were talking about if we were to have kids, what surname would they take? And like, I have no reason to say like, oh, they should definitely take like my last name, right? Like that's not an argument. And so I'm just kind of trying to assess with the seriousness of the moment in a way that just feels really sped up. And also I'm having folks reach out to me who I haven't spoken to in like 10 plus years because they've been following my social media accounts. And they're like, oh, maybe, you know, he's been engaged in the work. He can help me as I engage in the work. And that was never the nature of our relationship. Like I got people from high school reaching out. I got people from high school unfollowing me. And I'm like, what are y'all unfollowing me now for? Like I've been doing this. But I've been having a bunch of conversations, but not a bunch. I've had maybe a dozen people reach out and like say like, you know, we see you, like, can we talk? Is like, I have this awakening. And at first it was like, I was really short. I was like, I don't want to have this conversation. Like, you don't understand what it is to be like engaging in this self-reflection work to like figure out your identity is like, it's constant. And this idea that you could come in and get a few like bullet points and then be on your way, like that feels like, you're not respecting like my dignity or like even like humanity. So I've been trying to negotiate how I go about talking with people from back in the day when the nature of our relationship hasn't been where we're talking about race and ethnicity and other identity issues. Trying to be less short and meet people where they're at. And I don't know if it was Huey Newton or Fred Hampton who said it, but they were talking about when people have their awakening, like you got to meet them where they're at. That's how you build solidarity. That's how, you know, we build this movement. So I'm trying to like kind of channel some of the ancestors and their ideologies and figure out how I can shape it into my own. But it's fucking ungrounding. So that's kind of where I'm at.
Man. And I feel like this moment, everyone's just being pulled in so many different directions, and still like, it's hard to focus on like our own wellness and being in that space of like having to cater and take care of everyone else, right? Because that's what we're here to do, and folks just assume that that's our existence in the world. Mike, you were kind of talking to like meeting people where they're at, and I'm curious, like in the workspace, what does that look like? And y'all can speak to your actual workspace, or you can just talk about maybe what you see happening in other mental health agencies around you. But like, how are folks actually responding to the most recent instances of like police violence and like anti-blackness in the world? And are the other like clinicians, are like folks in positions of leadership, like, are they taking a stance? Are they talking about this right now?
From my own experience, I was working on building a really substantial wellness resource for the students with my colleagues. And we were wrapping up our meetings for the year, I think the week after George Floyd died. And I had some white colleagues reach out and make themselves available to take on some of the work that we had been delegated within our team, which I appreciated, because it was, I mean, that whole, that was a really hard week. And the idea of like trying to engage in work was not even a second thought. So I appreciated having people like say, like, we know what's, we recognize the time is serious, so we're going to try to step up. And again, that's from my experience. So I think I have, I work in a really supportive environment right now where people can, I can keep it a buck with the folks I work with, and I'll be heard.
I can't speak to your typical workplace because, you know, I'm at the group practice with the Radical Therapy Center, so we're all pretty much on the same page about everything going on. But I could imagine how, you know, organizations, maybe nonprofits, corporations, want to have these conversations, and I can imagine the people of color, specifically the Black people, still having to do a lot of teaching in those spaces. And, you know, it's you know, disappointing, because as the people who are being harmed in this, we don't have the energy to continue to teach. Like, we've, and especially when we've been trying to say, hey, everybody, this shit is happening. This is not okay. Hey, everybody, this person got murdered. It's not okay. Anybody care? And so now all of a sudden folks are wanting to have these conversations, and, you know, we're drained. we're drained. And now we're asked to participate in these conversations and then teach at the same time as processing and feeling these ways. And I can almost guarantee you that white folks are centering themselves in these, in a lot of these conversations about how they didn't know this was happening, or about how they feel so bad. You probably get a lot of white tears a lot about what's been happening. And the people of color are just kind of like, okay. You know, because like we don't need that. We need you to do something is what we need you to do. And Mike, you know, you mentioned, I forget who you quoted, but saying like to meet people where they're at. For Black people, fuck that. No, white people, you do that shit. Non-Black people of color, you do that shit. We've been trying. We've been screaming that we are here and we matter for so fucking long that no, we're not teaching. Unless you want to teach, if you have capacity to teach Black people, do it. But it is not your responsibility. Tell them to Google that shit.
In my experience, nothing that really matters and counts has taken place to do anything. It hasn't been a decentralization of whiteness. It hasn't been any investment in Black people. There hasn't been any more hiring of Black people to facilitate and be in leadership positions. There's been nothing. I think I saw a quote on Twitter the other day, and it said, I've experienced more violence at the hands of white liberals who openly chant Black Lives Matter, right? Talk is cheap, and we've said this over and over. The actions, I'm still looking for actions, and I'm probably not going to, after 401 years of being in this country, there's probably not going to be any actions. There has not been reparations. So, let's just look at historically. I don't know what they're going to keep doing what they're doing. And I was actually listening to something. I was listening to something the other day, and it said whiteness dictates norms and rules about who was allowed in what spaces, who was allowed to surveil whom, and who was allowed to call out whom. So I have put it like this. My experience is the total opposite of Marvin's in the Radical Therapy Center. Mm-hmm. It's still maintaining the status quo, maintaining complicity, and a bunch of white people talking fast, not saying nothing, smiling, and giving empty promises. So white people just being white people.
Mm. Yeah, it's like, it's very interesting for me to like just observe how people show up, and even folks that show up in a way that feels supportive right now, but maybe I remember back to like 5 years ago and maybe they were less vocal, and then I question like what that's about, and like, cool, you riding hard now, but why was that not the case before, and like what feels different? But yeah, just like everyone still seems on eggshells, and like you feel it in meetings, you feel the tension, you feel white people overly creating space for folks of color in a way that feels like a sense of obligation to fill that space, that like somehow we still need to be the ones to talk, even though it's like we've been saying this shit the whole time, been saying abolish the police, nothing has changed. But then it's like you show up to the meeting and it's like white people will not talk until you talk. They need to know it's safe to talk, because I imagine like part of the internal process is like worrying that like they're taking up too much space, but then in the effort to not take up space, they take up zero space, and then like we're left trying to guess like where they stand. It's just like the levels of it, man. Like it, I just like sit in meetings and I contemplate all these things, and I think even like in some of like the gestures, like kind of what you were speaking to, Mike, but I know this is probably not the case for you, but the gestures to reach out to people and check in on Black staff, and it's like, bro, like you've never talked to any of us, like why are you reaching out now, like what is your angle here? And so it's like, it's very confusing because it's hard to decipher like what feels like genuine action and what are pieces that are centered, like what you were saying, Josh, like centered in whiteness and allowing folks to alleviate their guilt. And so like the intention is to, how do I be a good ally, as opposed to how do I dismantle white supremacy? And I think those two things are received and feel very different when it's happening. So like, what are y'all thoughts on like, obviously, like a lot of people have started putting out images and graphics and kind of like taking their stand in a sense. And, you know, even like, I'm sure some of our organizations have done this, but like, how do you feel about so many people putting out that media of like, we stand with Black Lives Matter, like, you know, we're down with the cause, like whatever the fuck it is that they're saying right now.
If y'all can see Josh's hand gestures right now.
Man,
y'all can guess which fingers he's using. But
let me do a survey real quick with y'all. Is it reparations?
No.
Nope.
Is it more money for us to? Is it more money for us to live off of?
No.
Nope.
Is it white people taking away money from defunding and abolishing police?
Nope.
Nah.
Is it anything we asked for?
Street names, though.
Nah, son.
Yeah, they painted some shit in the street, bro.
Oh, yeah, that's just what we needed. Yo, I think everything, like, the other day I was listening to something with, like, there's a rapper named McCray, and he was having this discussion with this preacher in Atlanta about white privilege being a blessing being due to enslaving Africans, and then he shined Lecrae's shoes. Do we ask people to shine our shoes?
Nah, bro.
I just heard today that the NFL during, I don't know if y'all heard this, but during the first week of when the NFL starts, they're going to play Lift Every Voice and sing before every game that first week.
The Negro National Anthem?
How long has Colin Kaepernick been out of a job, though?
4 years. Right.
Also, that ain't gonna do nothing but piss people off. I'm not just thinking about that. Racist white people are damn sure gonna hate that shit. Who's winning? Who's winning there?
Drew Brees. Fuck Drew Brees, by the way.
Like, let's keep it real. These organizations, these corporations, these companies are doing this because that's what's hot right now. They don't want to lose money, and they want to let everyone else know, hey, look, we're a white organization and we have Black Lives Matter here, but we'll still have a board that's 100% white, but we'll still have the folks at the bottom of the totem pole are people, are people of color. So like, don't be fooled by this shit.
They don't want to lose money, right? I know the Breonna Taylor petition had like 6.4 million signatures on it. Do you know how many people posted a black square on Instagram the other day? Like 28 million. So we can see the discrepancy right there. You're doing it for clout. You're doing it to show like, yo, I'm down. I'm with the movement. But you're not signing the petitions. You're not calling the mayors, the governors, the senators.
Mind you, too, like just for like historical reference, Black Lives Matter, that term, the hashtag was coined in like 2013. We're in 2020. What does it mean to like put out some type of image or graphic saying we support Black Lives and we stand with the Black Lives Matter movement 7 years later?
when they say Black Lives Matter, they never tell you how they make Black Lives Matter. Can you give us, like, if we ask for a list of demands, can you give us a 10-point plan of how you plan to do that? I've seen nobody do that at all.
I you know what I've seen? I see Ice Cube recently put out something from the Big Three League, like a list of 10 demands. And one thing I saw, or I noticed that wasn't on that list, was freeing political prisoners and other revolutionaries, which I really wish had been on that list. Because I mess with Cube. I think he's doing a lot of good work. But I didn't see that on the list, and I was really disheartened. I think the NBA does a disservice by continuing to play out the rest of the season and try to make plans to hold it all down in Florida and like play on a court that might have the Black Lives Matter like words across it and like allow players to put social justice statements on their jerseys. Like, those are performative gestures, right? Those aren't actually structural changes. And i.e., like, I mean, you're, look at, we can examine the league. We can examine who the owners are. We can examine who are on the team's staff. And I would love it. I mean, if you're any type of organization, if you have a board of directors, post the pictures of who your board of directors are. Tie in all salaries of your top staff to like either like diversity. See, I'm even cringing as I say this, diversity, equity, inclusion goals.
Wait,
go ahead, Josh. Yep.
My bad. To add into what you're saying, you know what you take when you have diversity, inclusion, and equity? You know what that's an acronym for? DIE. D-I-E. Diversity, inclusion, equity. DIE.
And, I mean, we know that because what these initiatives are bringing in Black people and other people of color into structures that are harmful. And that ain't the move. That ain't the wave. But I do think tying in, like trying to tie in this idea like capitalism and monetary wealth to the people who are on like your ground level. Like, I don't know if it's a survey or something, like asking, hey, do you feel supported? Do you experience anti-Blackness? Like, whatever these people are experiencing, like, that should be tied into what you're bringing home at the end of the day. That's what I think. I don't, you know, y'all can jump on in. And
I did a processing group with an organization here in Philly. And first, the way that I structured it, the Black people spoke first, as far as that kind of open discussion. So the Black people spoke first, and then the non-Black people of color joined in after about 15 minutes. And then the white folks spoke last. And then also the white folks had very strict, not very strict, but very, I had to let them know, like, this isn't about you. Mm-hmm. Don't center yourself in your experience, but add on things to, you know, to this conversation. One of the white women suggested, and this is something that like would be great for, I think, a lot of different organizations, for groups of white people to figure out, to come up with smaller groups and figure out what they can do to support their Black colleagues. And then take it to your Black colleague and say, hey, we're thinking about this. How does this sound? Don't make the Black people and the people of color do all of that work. Come up, do something. That is doing, like, when we say do something, that is doing something. Also, Melanated Social Work is free to do processing groups for y'all too. But, you know, it's creating these spaces in which a lot of these organizations are expecting the Black people to be that voice, mm-hmm. when we're always that voice.
Yeah, the one person.
Always that voice. So take some of that work off of us, do your own research, like, come up with a group and give us something to say, hey, we want to do this because we value you, we appreciate you, and we want to make sure that you feel supported in this space. Is this okay?
I just thought, like, a really funny way to, like, adapt that process is, like you were saying, like, you start with, like, having, like, Black and Indigenous folks share their ideas, and then, like, have non-Black folks of color share their ideas, and then just keep telling the white people that they're next, but then you never get to them, and then you just, like, end the session. I mean, like, that would be, like, such an interesting way for folks to experience, like, what does it feel like to be silenced at work? You know what I mean? Like...
That's real though.
Yeah.
I was listening. I think one of y'all shared it in the group chat the other day, the Rachel Cargill, social work, so white, hashtag social work, so white. And she was saying that a lot of times white people do shit to make themselves, like we talking about the centralization, they do shit in social work and they do these well-intentioned so-called acts or gestures to make themselves feel better when they're really not doing anything. She was saying, Rachel was saying that she was somewhere in West Africa and there were like churches in Africa that had like, hi, I'm Kate from Ohio State and I did this, and it's Black people in there in a dilapidated church that nobody has helped to still cultivate, right? So she was also saying like the colonizing social work is like, who are these people that we're told that these are the pillars and the foundation for social work? Like, I was talking to my partner the other day, and I was saying, like, who's Jane Addams, the mother of social work? Mm-hmm. We know good and goddamn well it was some Black and Indigenous and brown women that was doing that shit before they coined the goddamn term social work. What about Sojourner Truth? What about Harriet Tubman? What about, was it social work when Black women had to nurse their child along with the white child? Like, there's all these acts and services and philanthropy. We may not have had money as Black, Indigenous, and people of color, but there's a lot of different ways in which we were community, and a lot of these things were done by Black, Indigenous, and women of color, but they don't get the credit. They give Jane Addams the credit at the Settlement House in Chicago, and they were saying, like, well, what makes them qualified? Why do you keep talking to us about these people? Mm-hmm. And for those reasons, that's why we got to talk about what George Edmund Haynes, who was the first African-American to graduate from what is now the Columbia University School of Social Work. What about Mary Church Terrell? What about Whitney M. Young, right? What about all the other Black and brown and Indigenous people that got these so-called MSWs, PhDs, licenses, and what have you? And also, I'm getting off into the topic, but a lot of times social work, there's been so much in social work to uproot and to terrorize, especially in America, Black and Indigenous people. We are on Indigenous land, and African Americans are brought here to make for business. Mm-hmm. This is the white man's business that we're just here for, mm-hmm. you know? And, you know, it's just a really, I said it probably last week, but, you know, in an effort to abolish the police and defund police, we may not be able to say it, but a rapper, Freddie Gibbs, once said, crime pays. The crime that happens pays these people. And Rachel Cargill was saying that a lot of these times, like, and the other person that was on the video was saying, like, we need to be working to not be in these jobs anymore. But a lot of times white people, they're living their livelihoods off the social work wise, the history of Black and Indigenous death. But also now all the people that show up in the ED, all these community violence things that happen, all these things white people are behind to make grants and to do all these things, but not there they're there to stay there, not to prevent these things from going on.
To capitalize on suffering.
Capitalize on suffering. Yep. Yeah. That's what white people do.
Josh, you reminded me when you were name dropping Freddie Gibbs and around the topic of like centering blackness, of an anecdote that happened, I think it was 2 years ago, at the college that I work at. Princess Nokia was the guest artist. And this is a message to all the entertainers, all the musicians out there. From what I heard through the people I work with, was that when she got on stage, she before she got into the music, Princess Nokia called all black identifying, all people of color, queer people to the front, and asked all white people to get to the back. And I had to hold these like process sort of that message with different people. Some people were like, I felt so fucking seen and heard and like visible when she called us to the front. And then I had other white folks be like, yo, I went to the spring concert and Princess Nokia is racist. Holding these different experiences. And it was so funny. But I also know like there's plenty of hip hop artists that will say, Kanye in particular gave white people permission to say the N-word like at his concert. Like, what the fuck is that?
Not me. She didn't say that shit knocked him out.
I mean, I don't know if it was like Gold Digger or whatever. So, I mean,
it was Gold Digger at a concert that I was at.
Mm. Right? So we say, y'all can say, it's like, no, that's so fucking harmful. So for any artist, channel that Princess Nokia vibe over to Yeezy.
Mm.
All I gotta say too, also with that, with Freddie Gibbs is a very polarizing person, if you know his story. He also said, I'm not gonna say the word, but he said, white people came to Africa, ravaged, raffled, and rummaged me. America was the name of their fucking company. And again, the Black Lives Matter, these empty gestures is all in an effort to appease themselves and for their own company of white supremacy.
So overwhelmingly, it sounds like we're all in agreement that the performative actions, the Instagram posts, it's all bullshit. We're calling bullshit. If you posted something in the year 2020 about Black Lives Matter and have been silent up until this point, we see you. So I'm just curious, like in terms of our work, you know what I mean? I think it's really easy to see and point out and name white supremacy because the shit is just like so palpable in the space. It's almost so overwhelming that it's hard to breathe at work at times. What would it actually look like to be anti-racist in social work?
When you ask that question, are we talking about on an individual level or are we talking about social work as a profession?
Well, I mean, like whatever you think, you know what I mean? Like we have this group of folks that are in school now or folks that are recently out of school and everyone's receiving this information, right? Like Ibram Kendi is like really having a moment with the how to be an anti-racist, right? Like everyone's thinking like, well, like it's not good enough to do this. Like I need to be anti-racist. Like it's not good enough to have cultural competence, not good enough for just DEI. Like I have to be an anti-racist. So what does it actually mean to dismantle white supremacy? What does it mean to be an anti-racist in the context of what we do, whether that's on an individual level within like schools of higher education, within like the institutions we work in, or you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think for one, if you are in a if you are in a university, give up your spot, give up your position, give up your tenure. I mean, Serena Williams' husband gave up his job and made sure, like, no, get a black person in here next, right?
And real quick, shout out Maya Moore.
Maya Moore, the Minnesota Lynx, she took off a year to help help somebody. And see, this is the thing: we didn't invent. If it's anything to do with anti-blackness, you would think the last person that should be fighting that fight is a black woman such as Maya Moore. Y'all know Maya Moore. Maya Moore is like a 30-year-old Minnesota Lynx Olympic gold medalist. I went to UConn. She helped to get a man who was supposed to be in prison for 50 years for a crime that did not have any DNA evidence. Mm-hmm. Nobody saw him do it. And even the crime that was allegedly that was there, the punishment does not fit that crime. But we see that time and time again in America. Mm-hmm.
Just so people have an understanding, like she's a four-time like WNBA champ, two-time gold medalist. Like it'd be like if LeBron James or James Harden or Kevin Durant like stepped away for a year to focus on social justice. Like I want to like bring that home. Like that's how serious, like that's my more doing this work.
So what does that energy look like in the context of social work? What are we asking like other social workers, other mental health providers, what are we asking them to do?
In terms of our student loans?
Yeah.
I think it really takes, like folks in organizations have to really take a look at what is in place now and really have like fine tune like different parts of like systems and things like that. And really take little things like fucking the break room. Like what's in the break room? Who is the break room for? Is it inviting? What posters are up in the break room? Put some more black shit in the break room. Have spaces that are only for black and brown people. Put in fucking allow black and brown people to have time, extra days if they need that shit, because some of this work in social work is so fucking taxing. When it comes to meetings, when it comes to you know, different events in which everyone is there, centering black and brown voices. I think looking at the work that even organizations are doing and seeing, okay, what do our clients look like, and what do our direct service workers and folks on the ground, what do our therapists look like, and making that, you know, having more black and brown folks doing that work. I think it's hard to answer because we've never really been asked that question, right? And people taking it serious, and like having white folks take it seriously to like put in that energy to actually make something anti-racist. So I think it's like, it's really hard to think about for me anyway, because I don't know, you know, we just got listened to. Like we just, we're all finally in agreement. Not even all of us, but a lot of us now are finally in agreement that black lives even matter. So now I'm thinking about like how to actually make organizations and systems anti-racist is like a conversation that I didn't even fathom I would be having right now. So yeah, I mean, I think it will take a lot of just work and a lot of white people in power giving up a lot of their power.
Mm-hmm. Bro, man, facts, dude. You that what you said really resonated. I have a hard time even imagining what that looks like, because it's like up until now I've been in survival mode. And it's hard to imagine and think creatively about like what life could be like when you're in survival mode. And
no one's ever asked, hey, what do you think this organization could do to better support you? Have any of y'all ever been asked that?
I mean,
not before this time.
Yeah. And never in a way that I really felt was genuine, or even in a way that like I felt like I could show up in a way that was genuine. Mm-hmm. I'm just like, is this a trap?
Right. And that question is usually for a bigger organizational goal, for like benefits them, not to benefit us. It's to benefit them so they can say, hey, look, we're doing this thing for these black people, so we're good.
Yeah. I guess like my biggest worry, like first off, a couple things. Like I think it's fucked up that we live in a world and occupy an existence where it is so hard to imagine what would it actually take and what would it look like for something to be anti-racist, that we've just become so bombarded by white supremacy that our ability to think in different ways is a stretch, like that's hard. You know what I mean? That like there isn't, the fact that there isn't a model that necessarily we can point to and be like that, like us just like generating it is difficult. And that shit is hella real. Mm-hmm. And then my worry is that, right, if we don't put it out there, these are the things that we want in the world. What are we left with? We're left with the performative gestures. We're left with white people making their best uneducated guess on what does it mean to be anti-racist, which that's fucking scary.
It is.
I mean, even now, like with the gestures, you see Pelosi wearing goddamn kente cloth. Like, what the fuck is that? And I feel as though for one, you don't see a lot of, I've only seen one white person actually admit to them being racist and like trying to do the work once ever in my whole life. I think another thing that I've learned as an African-American is that for one, our brothers and sisters that may not, they have their lineage and roots from another place. They have the benefit to be able to be like, all right, what we're going to do with this, what we're going to do is bill for our people and send the money back. With African-Americans, that was never the case. We lost all that. There was nothing to be like, well, what are we going to do now? It was just to work. And I think part of being an American that I've witnessed is the fact that if you're black, no matter what your nationality is, but a lot of times in workplaces, I've noticed probably since I was 19, that when a group of black people work together in a place, that threatens white people. White people want to break that shit up. They get mad that they're not a part of the camaraderie of that unspoken fellowship that we have. They want to question that. That threatens white supremacy. So for one thing, like I'm listening to what Marvin's saying is that space and adding on to that space, like I mentioned before many times, is this is not about you. Don't feel jealous and egocentric that you can't be a part of that space, and don't feel threatened by a bunch of black people working together and doing some stuff. That's one of the things that I think that they can do, and make Juneteenth a paid holiday for black people. And white people, you got to stay your ass at home.
Yeah.
My bad. You got to go to work. You stay home. We get paid. Y'all go to work and have to work.
There you go. I mean, yeah, it's hard. It's hard to imagine, too, because I imagine it's probably different in every context. I think the part that has to happen is I feel like the people in the workspace that are the most marginalized, which tends to be like the black women in the space, the indigenous folks, the queer folks, they need to be in positions where they can have power and make decisions on like, what is the culture of the space? How do we make decisions? How do we create policies? And even like the context of the work and thinking about even in that dynamic, that like so much of that gets decided without consulting the people we serve. So even like us in the workspace, we are marginalized, but we still hold more power than the people we serve. So then thinking about like, who are we here to serve, right? Like Josh, you were getting at this, like in terms of like the way that organizations and systems of mental health, how they capitalize on people's struggle, they capitalize on their pain. So it's like, how are we actually involving the folks on the ground, like the community, in that process of like, how do we do anti-racist work? And are they even a part of that process? You know what I mean? And having them decide like, well, what are the services that folks want? Because we just decided this is what we do. And then we just showed up. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. See, I think folks aren't ready for that power shift. White folks are not at all ready to give up power.
Okay. So then, I mean, that segue is real nice because so can an organization or an institution, can a college for that matter, be anti-racist if their board or their leadership team is still predominantly white? Is it even possible to be anti-racist? Not everyone at once.
I'm thinking of this. I'm like, it's like if I had a dollar bill or something or some paper currency and the edges had been burned off, so you don't know the value. It's like, well, this is money, here you go, but I don't have the value on it, and I don't know how much it's worth or what it is. It's like, how could you possibly claim to be anti-racist, but the people in the highest positions of power are not representative of the people that you're serving? It's like fake. It's like not, it's just not, there's no value to it. It's not real.
I think there's a level of privilege of having an all white anything that is just gonna, it's gonna be, as much as we, as they will try, I don't think they'll ever fully do what needs to be done, because none of them navigate the world as a person of color. And so they can read the books, they can read articles, they can listen to the Melanated Social Work podcast, but they will never understand what it's like. And I mean, I guess maybe if they have like Black people advising them, but if they have Black people advising them, then how come those Black people aren't in those positions of power? And so I'm going to say no.
And I'm going to say no as well, because even when those Black people, again, those Black people that are in power in these places, they still uphold white supremacy.
Boom. Yeah. I'm glad you said that, because I was thinking about, no. And I was also thinking if we were to replace those people in positions of power with people of color, like they could still uphold anti-Blackness mm-hmm. and racism. Mm-hmm. So it's...
Yeah, that goes on. There's some anti-Blackness in some communities of color in Boston I have to work with. That shit is fucking annoying. Yeah. And I feel like, you know, I don't know if this is even answering the question, but take somebody like no disrespect, but Angela McClain, who is the CEO of the NESW. Like, he's a Black man who went to BC. Shouts out to BC. And he's the CEO of the NESW. And shouts out to Kim Young of Richmond, Virginia. She did a petition to talk about just the disappointment that in the NASW, they supported an executive order on safe policing for safe communities, and that the social work profession is anchored in the values of service, social justice, dignity and worth, human relationships, competence, and integrity, all of which call on us to aid in the fight to dismantle systems of oppression. Our code of ethics demands us to act, to not join forces with the systems that uphold structural racism. So, like, I know we got asked, like, last week about something to do with social workers filling in or doing some stuff for social workers. Like, no, we don't want to get involved in a fucked up system already. I think it's more about, I say all that to say, it's all about, not to be funny, but an emergent strategy. Shouts out to Adrian Marie Brown. Thank you. I think in the chapter Decentralization and Interdependence, it's about having a coalition. Like in Boston, there's this thing called the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative. And it's about those similar initiatives coming together, pooling together, us putting away certain differences as, you know, Black people working with Black people working with brown people, all people of color coming together to decentralize what it is from white supremacy and coming up with our own list of demands, our own thing. This is nothing new. We've learned this from the Black Panthers and countless other Black communities and indigenous communities, queer communities as well, mm-hmm. because we can only trust in ourselves. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's unfortunate that many times the government infiltrates and destroys all these things, especially with Black people. But we can still go from the drawing board. We mm-hmm. don't got to put it on social media. We could just do it somewhere offline and do the real work away from the internet and then hopefully trust each other. It's not going to be an easy fight, but, you know, we have our lives to live and a legacy for the next generation. So it's really about us pulling with each other. And, you know, again, mm-hmm. all the well-meaning white people, if y'all want to go well-meaning, y'all need to go do your own thing. But right now, at this point, it's about us sticking together. And, you know, an emerging strategy talks about oak trees. A hurricane can not really mess up an oak tree too much because underneath the ground, there's an interconnectedness, and we have to continue to be interconnected within this work. Mm-hmm.
Man, I appreciate you bringing up Adrienne Marie Brown. Huge fan of hers. Adrienne Marie Brown, if somehow this gets back to you, we'd love to have you on the podcast because she got all the keys. But I love this piece on like decentralization, because I think that's a big part of it. Like, I think the way that, like, even looking beyond race, right? Like, the way that we have set up these institutions to operate in this hierarchical fashion, that's for whatever reason, we put more power and weight into the perspectives of, like, the ED than we do of the folks that actually, like, do the day-to-day work, like that is inherently problematic. Like we have to decentralize our power structures, and like the organization exists for a purpose, right? Because everyone has a role to play. But I think when we start ascribing value to, you know, where someone is in the hierarchy and how important they are, that becomes a problem. Because reality is like a lot of times the people that are at the very top, if they don't show up to work, the work still happens. They're actually not that integral to the work. But yeah, I think I agree with y'all. I think definitely there's no way that you can engage in anti-racist practice. And I think ultimately, like, anti-racism is a journey. It's not a goal. There's not an endpoint. You're never going to check all the boxes and be officially anti-racist, because like we live in a complex world where the context is constantly changing and our understanding about race is constantly changing too, and just the way that power moves in the world. And so ultimately, like, they're never going to be anti-racist, but they're for surely never going to get there if it's just all white people running shit. And I think about, like, what does that mean even for me? Like, you know what I mean? Like, being a non-Black person of color, I think even for myself, like, it can't be me. You know, like, it has to be someone else. Like, we literally in that space have to be lifting the most marginalized. You know what I mean? And so even me in my process of being a cis, het, non-Black person of color, like, nah, fam, that's not me. Like, part of my process of acknowledging that and really wanting to dismantle this racist system is like, I won't be in leadership, and I'm okay with that. You know what I mean? Because then that makes space for someone else who I feel like deserves that, you know?
Like maybe Feminista? Feminista Jones?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the Black women that have been out here doing the work, the Indigenous folks, the queer and trans folks, like, the folks who do the majority of the labor and the organization likes to uplift and put on the pamphlet, and like you're there on staff to like, we have diversity. Like, these are the folks that should actually be in positions of power that actually represent the communities that we're working with.
Every college or organization who uses people of color on their pamphlets, brochures, website should pay them.
Yeah. I mean, that's a big part of it, like compensation. Like, I don't think it's fucking crazy. Like, I honestly think that if you have an organization and you employ social workers, that base scale, you should pay the clinicians of color more money. Like, I don't think that shit's wild. I think that's actually anti-racist, is like, we can look at the ways in which like capitalism and just different policies have severely impacted the Black community and prevented them from generating assets and developing generational assets, that like, hey, we're going to do our small part right now and pay you more than we pay white people just because you Black. That's it. You could be fresh out of grad school and we're going to pay you more than white people because you probably had to work way fucking harder to get to this point.
Wait, but what about a statement with melanated social work about Black Lives Matter? Will that suffice? Put like our names in it and say that we're going to do some stuff and have us on the website, but you don't want to pay us to do anything or get into your grad programs?
Coming for BC, bro. Shots fired.
No. Yo. Right now. No, but I think, you know, and you know, at the Radical Therapy Center, when we have white clients that come and request therapy, they have to pay our full fee because we all offer sliding scale, but there are queer people, there are trans folks, there are Black folks that space could be for. And so you are now taking the spot of someone who actually needs it when you have hella options as a white person. You can go to nearly every single hospital, practice, whatever, and find a therapist that looks like you, that understands you and your experience. We can't say the same thing.
But Marvin, I didn't put you in slavery. I didn't do any of those things. That happened 100 years ago. Why do I have to pay for it? I didn't do that.
Cool. Because you find somewhere else to get to that. Even though you didn't do it, it was your ancestors. You reap the benefit of it.
Oh no, I'm not even explaining. Find somewhere else to go. Goodbye.
See, and maybe that's just how I operate in the world. Because even when Jesse, you were talking about Black people should just be paid more. Same job, pay them more. I found the first thing that came up to me was like, how do I articulate and communicate to the organization I'm applying for that they should pay me more? Like I tried to justify it. That's fucked up. I shouldn't have to do that. People shouldn't have to do that. Yeah. But of course, in interviews and you get offered a salary, there's going to be a negotiation that happens. And so that's part of, I think, probably just that process. I'm like, well, how do I justify that I should be paid more? Because I'm going to be doing hella labor outside of my, like during the 9 to 5 or whatever it is, but like with colleagues, with the people I'm working with organization, if I'm doing groups, like you're going to be doing X, Y, and Z, but that's not on the job description. But fuck that, just pay us more.
Yeah, but I mean, if we pay you more now, are you still going to complain about it later? Like, we give you everything and you still just complain.
Man, is it like you still going to be racist? Because if it is, you're going to hear about it.
No, no. Are you done or are you finished?
I started recently, I forgot exactly what it was, but white people are like, all right, we're going to listen to what black people are saying. The black people gave their answer to say, like, this is what we want. And the white people are like, we can't do it that way, but we can do it this way. That's what fucking happens.
Yeah, man. We're done with that. Like, that's it. Like, if you ask, which I think is what needs to happen, like, I think folks of color need to be in positions where they get to make decisions in terms of what it would actually look like to have your work be anti-racist. But if you ask, you better be ready to do that shit. No, like, not knowing what the fuck folks might say, but you better be ready for that shit and just it. No questions asked.
Something I picked up from Rachel Cargill was that, like, the amount of racism that I'll tolerate is zero. Like, I'm not working to just lesser some of this. And so I can feel a little bit like, no, I'm working towards there to zero.
Right.
And anything above that, I'm not accepting. And right. That's not okay.
That's real, man. Harriet Tubman, you know, she wasn't out here trying to reform the plantation.
How many white people are out here legit doing an anti-black work for real, for real? Please name them. Man. Don't worry, I'll wait.
Man, I'll put Jane Elliott on that list. She loves Jane making Elliott privileged white people cry, man. I wish all white people showed up like her, man. Yeah.
Y'all seen the memes? Like, in a world of Karens, be a Jane.
Yeah.
straight up.
Yeah, but I mean, there's not very many, real talk, like, especially within the context of social work and the context of therapy and the work that we do. The accomplices in the movement are far and few between.
Are white folks ready to talk about giving up their family wealth and what they inherit and redistributing it to black people?
But we worked hard. Like, we came from Italy. We worked hard. My family didn't have a degree. My grandfather, he had 12 cents when he came to America. Why do I have to give that up for you people?
Damn, he hit us with the you people at the end, too.
Right. Yeah, but it's real. Like, and to what degree, and even like, you know, like, to what degree is anyone ready to give up their power?
Mm.
Because I know even for myself and thinking about experiences in my life, like, it's difficult and uncomfortable and there's a lot of fear and anxiety associated with that. And so, like, I think folks will lean towards the symbolic gestures as a way to try and appease folks and see how much longer they can stay in their position of power without anyone calling them out on it.
Mm-hmm. There's a safety net and people are very comfortable within it.
Yeah.
I think what we're asking people to do is venture out.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, if you've never been put in that position or you're first stepping into a space of like trying to be accountable, like that could be unfamiliar. You know what I mean? Especially in relation to the ways in which you've caused racial harm. If there's never been a point in your life where you've had to be accountable for that, like, you ain't gonna know what the fuck to do with that. Like, but the good thing is you can just listen to the black folks. Like,
true.
They'll tell you what to do and that's it. Like, you know what I mean? But just listen. Like, in the midst of all the protests and the uprising, the revolution that's happening right now, folks are really finally starting to get on board with the idea of defunding and abolishing the police. What are y'all perspectives on this? Because I know just in the midst of like talking about this, people are talking about, okay, like we invest in social workers, we invest in mental health professionals. Like what is coming up for y'all right now in terms of the conversation of like social workers either like partnering or acting in replace of the police?
Man, I think that there are so many narratives about out there about what defunding the police, abolish the police looks like that I'm having a hard time making sense of what's going on in what city, what are people actually working towards, and trying to combat a lot of the misconceptions. Because I think right now there's some, I've seen things circulate about, well, y'all want to defund the police, so what y'all going to do when a murder happens? You going to send a social worker? I'm like, fuck no. Hell no. But that's not what the call is for. In fact, the call is for, we live in a world where the murder's not happening, where the harm's not happening. Obviously, we have ways to go considering the toxicity that we all trying to live in. So right now, I'm just trying to make sense of it and keep up.
Where I'm at with it right now is just being patient. I don't think we're going to be able to see a fully abolished police, law enforcement. There's so much money in it. There's some white people out there willing to fucking die to make sure that there's such a thing called law and order. Like they don't, you know, they'll go through some extremes to make sure. And, you know, I don't know if I can go up against that will, or I don't even know too much about that. We've been so engulfed in this system for so long that for people, it's a way of like, a comfort, right? I believe there needs to be some secure ways that our country should be protected, but not also at the same time, we should not terrorize Black communities, Indigenous communities, Latinx communities, queer communities. And also, it's just so hard to even think about that right now, because I mean, really, it's really forces. Law enforcement in America gets trained by Israeli forces to continue to incorporate, in a sense, police violence on these communities. So I think, in a sense, it's going to take time. I think the start is defunding the police. It may take 100 years. We're not going to see that happen in our lifetime. But I think a start is just to put more money elsewhere so that you don't need the police, right? They spend $500 million on law enforcement, but what about the schools? What about social services? What about every other thing that would not need the police if you invested in it? And I mean, you know, what would that look like? And what would that look like to invest more in crisis teams, to invest more in 24/7 mental health services, right? It's just a lot. It's just a thought. It's a lot to think about. I don't think it's going to happen overnight, but I think this is the beginning of the end for them. That's where I stand with it.
I'm going to name one thing real quick about something that I had said about like, what you going to do if there's a murder? And the misconception is that there's violent crimes happening all the time, and so we need police. But the reality is like, I can name like 10 major cities where the percentage of calls for violent crime are 4% or less. So The reality is cops are not spending their time going out and a majority of their time going out and like trying to solve murders or deal with other violent crimes.
Well, I think the more problematic perception is not even whether they're responding to them, but people seem to be under the belief that the existence of police prevents violent crimes.
I mean, that's false, right? Right. I mean, even after Columbine, there was a surplus of or like this initiative to put police in schools, like millions of dollars, thousands of officers in schools. And how many school shootings did they stop? The percentage is like 1% or less.
Yeah.
When I think of putting social workers, you know, to in police, as to be pretty much part of that police system, I think about like a house that's on fire and someone giving you like a random ass hose, like just a, not like a, you know, like a firefighter grade hose, but just like a random ass, like
just small, like the green joint, the one we used to drink out of.
Right. what the fuck is that going to do?
Yeah.
You still have this big ass house that's on fire. Right. You still have social workers that are going to have to navigate this racist, sexist, homophobic, fucking these police districts. I remember when I sat in the police station my second year internship, and I went into the break room of this police station, and 24/7 there was news on. Guess what news station was on?
Fox News
24/7. So cool, we know where you all stand. And so like to put a social worker in that environment, one is problematic. I'm thinking about the clients and how, and maybe Jesse and I think all of us have worked in schools at some capacity, but as the social worker or as the therapist, if you were to walk in the room with like that disciplinary person, that kid doesn't see you as therapist. They see you as another adult that's here to like get them in trouble. And so I think that similarly, a lot of citizens will see a cop and somebody with a cop, and it's just like, well, that's your boy. I don't trust your motherfucking ass either. Right. And so like, now we're not going to be seen as social workers. We're going to be seen as helpers of law enforcement. And I don't want to be seen as that shit. what happens when a police officer wants to shoot and a social worker is saying, no, don't shoot? Who has the authority in that situation? And so like all these situations, and then think about some of the social workers in training that we went to school with. Do we want them working with police? Not all of them. You know, and so, you know, it's so easy to put like a Band-Aid on situations. And that is what America is so fucking good at, is putting Band-Aids on all these situations that require surgery. And this is just another example. We don't know how it's going to work, but We're gonna put that there, and it'll work itself out. They'll figure it out.
And see, with that too, Mike brought up a really dope point last week. So if something happens with us social work wise that probably is unethical, or if we don't section somebody the right way, what happens? We lose our license, right? What happens? You mentioned surgery, right? What happens if they leave something within, so they stitch somebody up and leave something with somebody? They lose their license, right? There's no code of, from what I've seen, cops, they don't lose their jobs. They still stick with their pensions. They can still have their livelihood. They get put on paid vacations after they kill black people.
That we fucking pay for, by the way.
You see what I'm saying? Like, there's no level of justice for them, or integrity, or a level of actions. The thing is like, there's like, really, there's no punitive things that happen to them when they fuck up. They fuck up, they just get to maybe stay in the station and do something else, but they're still using our tax dollars to enforce racism on us with impunity. There's like, what, the dude Darren, who murdered Mike Brown, right? The fuck did he do? The dude who murdered Oscar Grant. The dudes right now for Breonna Taylor. Mm-hmm. What the fuck are they doing? They're not doing anything. They're off the streets, but they're still getting paid by tax dollars. Impunity.
It's wild that you can take the life of somebody and then potentially the worst thing that would happen to you would be that you lose your job. And that's not even happening for the people who murdered Breonna Taylor. Pay, are they suspended with pay? No, one was just fired, I think, right? That was it.
Yeah, I don't know. But this is always a good time for a reminder, y'all. Arrest the murderers of Breonna Taylor. Shit.
Yo, for real. Call the mayor, call the governor, call the senators of Kentucky. I mean, they just pumped a bunch of money in their police department. Like Louisville's.
Yeah.
Shout out, I mean, you know,
no disrespect to people out there, but they're doing it backwards right now.
Yeah. I want to believe that in my lifetime, we will abolish police. Because I don't know if I ever imagined in 2020 that there would be a national conversation around defunding the police. And when I think about that, I feel like it opens my mind to like all the possibilities that could happen because of that. Like, I honestly think like that'd be tight. Like, and then we could abolish the police, and then we could abolish prisons, and then like Palestine could be free. Like, I just like, boom, like bigger and bigger scale. Like, why not? If I never thought in 2020 we'd be having a conversation about defund the police, why not? Like, why couldn't we abolish prisons? Like, that's totally within the realm of possibility. All we have to do is imagine it and then make that shit happen. I think we oftentimes settle for the reform, right? We're like, defund the police. What we want is abolish the police. We want them totally gone. But if someone says like, oh yeah, we'll cut the budget by 50%, we'll take that. You know what I mean? Because we're just like, oh, we'll just take what we can get in this moment. Mm-hmm. But the reality is like, we can dream for more. We can want more than that. And I think social work has a long way to go in terms of like what we've spoken to and the ways in which that there is anti-Black racism within social work. And mental health providers have caused harm to the Black community in a different way than the police have, but still caused harm. I think there's ways in which we still need to atone for that as a profession and try to think through the ways in which how social workers are going to engage in anti-racist work. But I think ultimately, like, I don't know if it's social workers who get to decide whether or not they take the place of police. Is like, is that even what the community wants?
Hell no.
You know, like, I think that's what we give back to is like, our folks in these communities, if they're calling for defunding the police, you know, it's like, the folks who are on the ground doing the work, you know, that's not all the social workers. They're not all the ones out there. You know what I mean? So the community, like, what do they actually want? What do folks need? Like, how do we give power to folks that, you know, on the streets to then be able to make the decisions? Like, cause we're just operating under this assumption, like, oh yeah, social workers could do that. Maybe that's not what folks want. Maybe folks want more money towards housing. Maybe folks want more money towards employment services. You know what I mean? Like,
or the schools. Yeah. I was shocked when I saw that there was this call for social workers to like step up. I was like, what?
Fuck that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's also just like a misconception about that people hold about like who we are and what we do.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. I tell you what, I'm not closely aligned with the police and I don't want to be. Aside from, you can redistribute some of those police salaries to social workers who are making 200 and 300K or more.
Yeah. I will say, like, I feel like I'm pretty good at de-escalating crisis. And I imagine I'm a million times better than de-escalating crisis than any police officer is.
Have you ever used a weapon?
Nah, man. Never used a weapon. It's mostly just my voice, man. It's just soothing. You know what I mean? But that's the thing. Like, I feel like if there was a call and I feel like it was community led and I feel like they had values around liberation and the shit was anti-racist and trying to, you know, dismantle systems of oppression, and they called for social workers to come in and we could take part in this effort that we knew was building towards abolishing police, I'd do that shit. I'd be like, yeah, sure. Why not? I'm trained. I could do this shit. I don't mind showing up. And then you get me instead of a police officer knocking on your door. I think people would welcome that.
That's great. There's also, the game is so fucked up where there's internalized oppression and there's some communities who do want to have cops to enforce martial law on people that look like them, right? And there's also, the game is so fucked up in some places to where there's not a lot of opportunities for some Black and brown people. So they don't want to go and deal dope. They may not want to go do military time. So what they're going to do is they're going to get a $100,000 job being a cop. They're going to be behind the blue wall because they don't have other options. That's a whole nother conversation. But I think the game is so fucked up at times where people don't have any other options. Sometimes our own people, right? So they're like, all right, either get out and lay down. I'm going to go do this, right? That's how fucked up the game is.
Yeah. But then it's like getting back to like us thinking outside of like any models that exist, right? Exactly. Like you said, like, oh, I can't deal dope, but like, what if we redistributed funding from the police to allow Black folks to actually engage in this like legal marijuana business, that we could support folks in starting dispensaries as opposed to like locking folks up? You know what I mean? Like,
hey, Russ, free everybody who's been convicted of possessing marijuana.
White people's privilege is too, their white privilege is too fragile to give up what they have to let Black and brown people out of incarceration for selling marijuana, where they're building shit in Denver, Seattle, Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like, we have, I don't even, the whole law enforcement thing, like, you'll see law enforcement in other countries. They don't use, some of them, many of them, not all, but they'll know how to, they'll be better at de-escalating situations than American cops without a fucking gun. We've seen this on social media. They don't even want to do that. Mm-hmm. White people in America have a mental illness called white fragility and white privilege, comorbidity, that they can't not see a world that doesn't supply and revolve around their protection, their money, their legacy, their ego. Mm-hmm. I've seen some shit recently on social media and such where, again, white people's will, and I'm saying all of y'all, because if there's good ones of y'all, where are y'all when y'all need to hang, go holler at your peoples? I don't really see y'all doing that. And also, going off on a tangent, stop doing Black Lives Matter shit around and burning shit down, because Black people got to get blamed for that shit too. So, but a lot of them on the way of the side, their will is so deep to maintain the status quo. They're on some white jihad shit, man. I don't have that will to like them, you know? I can't go against that shit. That's, hey, you got that. I mean, hey.
I've seen two videos in the past week of white people pointing guns at people of color. One was in Louisville with the lawyers pointing the guns at the protesters. And the other one was this woman who was upset after like a traffic incident. But I was going to name, there's a sheriff in Florida, Black dude, who is saying that if the protests get violent, he's going to deputize every gun-owning citizen in the county. Mm. That's scary as hell.
Well, I think also white people know what they've done. They don't, they like to pretend to forget about slavery and Jim Crow and, you know, school to prison pipe. Just, and I can keep naming shit, but I think they know what they've done, and they know that there are more of us now, people of color in general, than they are. And they are so fucking scared of losing the power that they have built and that their ancestors have built. They're so fucking scared because they know what they've done, and they know that they fucked us over for as long as this country has been around. And so they know that, like, these peaceful protesters can turn violent because of all of the fucked up shit that white people have done, and it's completely justified. So I'm going to protect myself and make sure that doesn't happen, because they know.
Yeah.
I mean, that we're on the cusp of America's independence. My independence is Juneteenth, but we're on the cusp of the beginning or the eve of their independence. Right.
Mm-hmm.
My brother had a podcast about what is July 4th to the Negro, something to do with like Frederick Douglass or something like that. And even back in those days in the Revolutionary Wars and all these things, white soldiers were afraid to give Black men muskets because they're like, oh, we are enslaved these people or something like that. They can turn around and blow our fucking head off.
Mm.
It's been like that for centuries. And it still happens today. That at their core, that subconscious is fear and guilt. That's why they're arming themselves like white jihadists as they are.
When you name the war, I was reminded of that Spike Lee production I was talking about, The Five Bloods, in which he was dropping jewels and was saying at the time of the Vietnam War, Black people made up 11% of the population, but were 32% of the soldiers in the Vietnam War.
Ooh. Man, we are on a precipice moment, y'all. Like, you can hear the revolution coming. And that's going to be it, man. Whether white folks are willing to give their power or not, the reality is it's going to get to a point where someone might just take their power. Like we are, as folks of color, the ethnic majority. And I think like that speaks to that fear, is that white people within institutions, within the world, have always operated in this space of power and privilege and assumed that they were just inherently better. And there's so many reminders right now that that's not the case. And folks are out here willing to put their lives on the line. And I really do believe that there is power in the people. White folks could go ahead and arm themselves, but there is definitely power in the people. And I think that fear that they have, a lot of folks of color have had to live with that fear their entire lives. This fear that they worry that somehow their power is going to be taken. Like a lot of folks of color have had to live under that oppression and fear that like their lives could be taken at any moment. And so like, who really has more to lose in that scenario?
I feel as though also like I've seen a lot of things with those in the motherland, our brothers and sisters over there. They're rooting for us over here. They're like, I saw something from CNN. Ghana's like, African Americans, come back to your homeland. You know, I even saw like they're praying for us. They have us. They know kind of like what's up. Yeah. I mean, Beanie Siegel said, get down and lay down. And sooner or later, it's going to come to that point with them. And I want to shout out Healing While Black from IG. He's a brother that's, I think, out in Amherst. I know we posted the other day about something to do with paying and helping black women post or black women get money for their licenses. That's not our thing. We just posted that for him. But shouts out to him, because a lot of these times, more vulnerable than us as four men of color are black women, gender non-performing, right? If it's anything as far as that, black women need to be the ones at the forefront to stay armed, because, you know, they're the bedrock to the world, man. They're the bedrock to America, and we need to be able to arm them and protect them and make sure that they, you know, get protection and they get their just due. Because we can talk and say all these things, but if it's anything, we got to use our privileges for men of color, cisgender, to make sure that we're using our voice to, you know, give up power and also make sure that they're at the top and the paramount. So as we climb, we lift them up and make sure we protect them and do what we need to do.
Yes, sir. I was thinking about the call to protect oneself and tying it into a question that was asked earlier about what does anti-racism look like? And all I could kind of conjure up was like, the feeling, like I want to feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I yearn for.
Yeah.
To feel safe in any space.
Yeah. Which doesn't feel like a lot to ask for. But oftentimes folks have to move throughout the world and not getting to feel much of a sense of safety anywhere, even in their own homes, as we've seen with some of these instances of police murder. So then we continue to move throughout this white supremacist world and operate in these white supremacist institutions. Like, what have y'all been doing and what do you need to continue to stay well and feel safe?
I'll just say I want 40 acres and a mule.
I would love for all of my financial burdens to be taken care of. There's a chronic stress that I think Black people live with who either, you know, don't have access to quality resources, live in debt. Like, that shit is omnipresent and it's chronic. And it's like, what is it like to like not have that burden? I don't know. Be cool to find out on a level a little bit closer. I'm removed, man. I'm kind of removed from people and I feel safe. I feel safer being removed from people, which is actually something I just want to show gratitude towards, because I think where I'm at, like, I don't have to have many run-ins with folks aside from my walk that I take. Otherwise, I'm trying to quarantine. But like, shit, that's how I cultivate safety.
Mm-hmm.
And shout out to my partner and her family. Shout out to my mother and my brother and my family, because staying in touch with them folks you know, it's always can be humbling at times, and other times it speaks life, and I just wouldn't be where I'm at without this their support.
I think about how free it must feel mentally, spiritually, emotionally to be a cishet white man. I want that feeling. I don't want to be a cishet white man, but that feeling of not having to adjust for anybody, not having to code switch, not having to worry about, you know, how I'm perceived by other people in various spaces. Mm-hmm. I don't know how I get there. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I think utilizing my village and my community has been helping me with my wellness and has keeping me safe in all forms of the word safe.
For sure, man. Yeah, I think I want to just continue to lean in this space of trying to draw upon my imagination. And like, I'm feeling incredibly inspired right now by the work of Octavia Butler and thinking about the work of Adrienne Marie Brown and everything that they've put before us in terms of like, what does it look like to reimagine society? And a lot of that work being focused on like the dystopian universe. And they talk about like in any science fiction, if there is a utopia, there is a dystopia. And so just trying to think about like, what would it actually look like if we were to get rid of all of these systems of oppression? And how do I be in that moment? And how do I start to imagine things outside of what's already been imagined or what already exists? And really trying to move myself from this practice of just tearing down or trying to destroy what exists, as opposed to like focusing so much of my energy on dismantling white supremacy, but then how do I build something else? How do I build liberation? Yeah, and trying to figure out like, where does that fit in my life? Because I feel like that's where I feel safe, when I get to feel like there's other possibilities. I don't feel so overwhelmed or burdened by the idea that it's like, this is what it is. This is what it's going to be for the rest of my life. But I get to have these brief moments that I can feel or see something different on the horizon. And I think connecting with y'all, like, and being able to connect with like-minded folks that are in that process as well. And like y'all spoke to, like my partner and like my other chosen family, and just like being able to trying to envision something, like those are the spaces that I feel safe, and just reminding myself that I can drop into that, you know? Yeah. Let's show y'all. Well, I appreciate y'all sticking with us. That's it. This is another edition of the Melanated Social Work Podcast. Please, if you don't already, follow us on Instagram. Make sure you tune in to Melanated Mindfulness Mondays every Monday. Click on the link tree, donate to the Venmo or to the Cash App, check out the merchandise. You know, but yeah, we appreciate all the love y'all give us and all the support. That's it. Peace.